Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I don't know why I haven't been down here all weekend when I saw your hostesses and... You know where I was? Manresa. Jesuit retreat. Male, all male. And I might just as well have been down here. But I'm here now. And I'm glad. Really, all I came down here to do was tell you I love you. I love you. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to change. I just love you. If you're drunk, you don't even have to get sober. If you're a liar, you don't have to quit lying. If you're a thief, you don't even have to quit thieving. I love you. Because I know who you are, whether you do or not. You're God's kids. Even as I am. And as such, you're all right with me. It's been my happy privilege to spend a lot of time with you. It's been 35 years and 7 months since I had a drink of liquor, a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind, for which I am profoundly grateful, but not as grateful for that as I am that I have lived for 35 years and 7 months without one conscious desire for a drink. Now I've been called a goddamn liar in open meeting for saying that, particularly in my home group. But it's truth. And I'm so grateful for that, because had I had a constant desire for a drink, I'd have gotten drunk. I always did. So, I am most grateful for the way I got here. I can stand up here this morning and tell you I thank God for hell. I thank God for hell. Because I had to die before I could come here. And I want to tell you a little about my last sojourn at the well. On the Friday before Christmas, 1945, I went to the office feeling right good, because it was Christmas coming right up, and New Year's. And Christmas and New Year's, I could get by with a little more drinking than usual, because it was sort of a good time to drink, and people weren't quite so critical. So I knew that I had some good days coming up. And I felt pretty good about it. But I got to the office, and I had a summons to see the boss. And I didn't want to see him. I knew what he looked like. And I knew what he wanted with me. He was going to can me. Because I knew I had it coming. But the summons was to see the boss. And I went in to see him. And instead of shooting me right off the bat, as he had every right to do, he started talking, which was a good sign. And he said something like this to me. He says, Charlie, I was Charlie in business. He says, you've had a lot of trouble this year. Now, he didn't mention booze. But he knew that I knew what he meant when he said trouble. And he proceeded. He says, I think I know your problem. He says, I think it's because of the pressure you're under. Now, says he, I'm going to take a little pressure off of you. And again, instead of shooting me, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945. To take the pressure off of me. If you don't think he took the pressure off of me, you're nuts. There's one thing worse than bad fortune for an alcoholic, and that's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. And I never came to until sometime after the middle of January 1946. Now, had I any memory at all of that 4 weeks' time, I'm quite sure I'm smart enough to figure out a reason that I could take credit for these last 35 years. But I can't remember nothing. I can't remember the first drink, the middle drink, or the last drink. The last thing I remembered, it was Friday before Christmas, 45, and the next thing it was after the middle of January, 46. And sometime between the Friday before Christmas and the middle of January, everything between me and me burned out. Every excuse was gone. And every I want was gone. And I had only one piece of unfinished business. I didn't want to die with a record. I didn't want my wife and kids to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk. And I had to not drink for such time as I had left, so I could use the time rubbing out the record as well as I could. But I didn't know how not to drink right now. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew the inside of jails. I knew the DTs. I knew convulsions. I knew messy beds and no beds. But I didn't know anything about alcoholism. That morning, for the first time, I remembered that Mrs. C. had found Jack Alexander's article in the Post. March 1st, issue 1941, which was about 4.5 years prior to this time. She had read it, decided that it would probably do me some good if I would read it. And she had left it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now. Hoping that if I came in, I'd read it. And evidently I did. But I was drunk when I read it. And I only remember two things about it that morning. I remembered that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. The only two things I remember. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And immediately, my little period of sanity was over. I was sickened to death, drunk and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the moment of commitment until right now, I've never had a drink or a pill. Such is the great significance of this thing called surrender. Surrender! Would to God I could explain to one audience what it means to surrender. This is the most misunderstood experience in human life. Our entire so-called civilization is built on the fact that the strong man wins, the weak man surrenders. Surrender is a dirty word, you know. And yet it's the most fantastic thing that can happen to anybody. When I got well enough, I started looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know where to look. My keen alcoholic mind told me you wouldn't be in the phone book. You were anonymous, weren't you? They don't anonymous in the phone book. So knowing you weren't there, I never looked. That's the story of my life. I knew so damn much that wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything that was. So I started calling people, asking them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a hold of a doctor in Beverly Hills, and he gave me a chap's name, telephone number, member of our society. And I called him, and we talked a little while, and he said to me, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No." But he said, "Don't take one." He said, "I've got to work tonight, and I can't take you to meeting." He was a motion picture man. He said, "I can't take you to meeting tonight. But maybe I won't be working tomorrow night. So call me tomorrow." And I called him tomorrow and we talked a little while. He says, "You had a drink today?" And I said, "No." He says, "Don't take one, I'm still working." "Call me tomorrow." So I called him the third day. And this time he started going and I said to him, "I know, you're still working." He says, "Yeah." I says, "You don't have to take me to meeting. Where is there a meeting I can go to? I'll go on my own power." And he told me. And I decided to go. And I was pretty happy about it, really. Until about 10 minutes before time to start. And then I did the unforgivable thing. I started to think. Now, this is the second thing I came down here to tell you. Quit thinking! Quit thinking. That's why we're here today. Thinking. So cut it out. We can live ourselves in the right thinking, but we can't think ourselves in the right living. So I can start to think. And again, my keen alcoholic mind tricked me a little. He said, "Look, son, you've lived in Beverly Hills a long time. And it might not be good for your reputation to be seen with a bunch of drunks. Now, you never will know how funny that is. Because in my last 10 years, the only guy that spent more time in the Beverly Hills jail than I did was the jailer. And yeah, I'm concerned about being seen with a bunch of people who are doing something about their drinking. Isn't that awful?" So I thought about it a bit, and I had to come because I had to find out how not to drink so I could use the time rubbing out the record. And I decided to disguise myself a little so I wouldn't be so easily recognized, which I did. And it came time, and I sallied forth. It's a big hall, big as this. Right in the middle of the back wall, there was a door, open door. And I walked up that door and looked in. And there might have been 35 people standing in the middle of that big room. Every one of them talking, nobody listening. It's been that way ever since. And I watched it a little bit. And again, my keen alcoholic mind got to work. And it told me that you'd given me the wrong information. This was the wrong night. Because this is the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And I said to myself, these are the veterans and their wives. And they're here for a party. And I'm going to have to leave and come back the night the drunks are here. And I turned to leave. And insofar as I'm concerned, the next minute of what I have to say is Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody in the middle of that room had been watching me. And when I turned to leave, he trotted over to the door and he called after me. He says, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." But he says, "What were you looking for then?" And thinking he was a veteran, I said, "Well, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And everything about that man changed just like that. He lit up all over. And it was obvious to me that he was glad I was there. Now, this is a man I'd never seen before. And my own flesh and blood wouldn't even spit on me. And he was so glad I was there, he lit up. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And when he did, he said, "Why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place." He didn't know it, but he took away my disguise there. That was my disguise, my hat and coat. So he even took away my disguise. Took me back and told me about you. Which was about me. Thank you. I remember that meeting better than I remember last night's meeting. You know? Everything about it, I remember. First thing he said to me is, "If you're an alcoholic, one drink's too many and 1,000 aren't enough." He says, "It's the first drink that's killing you. If you're an alcoholic, the first drink that you must not take. Because if you don't take the first one, you won't take the second one." I played with it a little while and bought it, and I've still got it. The second thing he told me, and I wouldn't take a half of Texas for this. He says, "Today's the day we don't drink. Today's the day we don't drink." If he'd have told me I had to be sober 35 years, I'd drop dead. If he just said 35 days, I'd have dropped dead. But he didn't. He says, "Today's the day we don't drink." And he says, "If a day is too long, how about an hour? Can you live an hour without drinking? Live an hour and don't drink, and then do it again." But, says he, regardless of how long you live in AA, never expand that time more than 24 hours. 24 hours, as long as you'll ever live in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I played with that, and I bought that. And I've still got it. And it's the second greatest lesson I've ever learned in my life. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. One of the reasons it took me so long to get here. I'd come 2 a.m. and I'd have to have a drink. I mean a tumbler full of whiskey. Because otherwise I couldn't get up and dress and shave. But I wouldn't take it. I'd lie there and I'd look at yesterday. And I would see that I had drunk too much whiskey. And I would decide today I'm just going to drink what I have to live. And tomorrow, when I come to, I won't have to take that tumbler of whiskey. And I'd sell myself that idea. And then I'd get up and take the tumbler of whiskey. Shave and dress and get busy. I wasn't going to do that tomorrow. Today I wasn't going to do it, so tomorrow I wouldn't have to take the tumbler of whiskey. But when I came to the next morning, it wasn't the next morning. It was right now. And I was thirsty. And I had to do it all over again, you see. So, I'm convinced that right now is the only time you and I will ever know. Right now is, as far as I'm concerned, eternity. Tomorrow never comes. Second greatest lesson ever learned is this is my day. I have no past. I want no future. You know that yesterday is nothing but guilt. Nothing but guilt. And tomorrow is nothing but fear. If I were dependent on what I read in the newspapers, hear over the TV news, you know, and see what's going on in the world, if I were dependent on that for my peace of mind and serenity of purpose, I wouldn't even finish this talk. I'd tell you, call an ambulance, I'm going to have a heart attack. But I never look at that. Today is my day. I have no past. I want no future. And when we live that way, we duck the guilt and we duck the fear. We don't have it. I highly recommend this day. The next thing you told me was stay close to us. You said to me, there's more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than in any other room on the face of the earth, except another room just like this, where AA members are meeting. So get into as many meetings as you can. And I played with that a while and bought it. And I've still got it. I attend a meeting every once in a while. I wouldn't be surprised, and I have near 5 and 4 meetings a week. 35 years and 7 months. And I've never gone to one too many. And you might say to me, how do you know? Simplest yardstick in the world. I never had it so good. This is the only good life I've ever known. The only easy life that's ever been mine. And I'll still be coming to these meetings. Until you pat me in the face with a scoop. Because I love them. I love these meetings and I love the people that come to them. And the next thing you told me was, why I can't drink like other people. Now this is the only intellectual knowledge you and I need that we didn't have when we got here. Because this is not a program of great intellect. Nor is it a program of great ability. It's a program of attitude and effort. Attitude and effort. But it's good to know why we can't drink like the non-alcoholic. This used to just drive me nuts. Because it was evident to me that I was smarter than any of you mutts. Nobody that drank with me was as smart as I was. But somehow or another, they didn't get in jail. And I did. You know? I was quite a poker player in those years. And I was a good one. And I'd get in a poker game, and last I would remember, I had all the money on the table. And I'd come to the next morning and thinking I was rich. Until the phone started ringing. And then these monkeys would tell me what I owed them. And it used to just burn me up. Because they waited till I passed out and then took my money. And they're supposed to be my friends. You know? But they weren't, they didn't pass out. They're getting the jailhouse. They just got my money. And I can understand this. It's good to know. Why can't I successfully drink liquor? You told me. First night, you said that this disease was a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Now, you said the allergy of the body means simply this, that if you be an alcoholic, your body cannot successfully handle alcohol. You can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. You take one slug of liquor, and it goes into the bloodstream of the brain, and it triggers a physical demand that makes you keep on drinking till your cycles run. So, it's the first drink that you must take. Now they said to me, there's nothing we can do about the physical part of the disease. And nothing anybody else can do about it. All we can do is to recognize it. And admit it. And then turn to the other half of the disease. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to take the first drink. And said, you, that's what this program is all about. To make it unnecessary for it to take the first drink. For us to take the first drink. Because, you see, our body cannot successfully handle alcohol, and our minds cannot successfully keep from drinking, because the compulsions are greater than the willpower. So, we have our program. Which is not for the physical side of the disease at all, but for the mental part of it. Rid of the necessity to take the first drink, and we don't then take the second. And I bought that, and I've still got it. And it's a fantastic thing to me. You know, my wife is still with me. After, I guess, 46 years, 56 years. Whew! Isn't that awful? That's indecent in California. Same broad for 56 years. And you know something? She belongs to another society. Sort of a sister organization to ours. I think they call it Al-Anon and Anon and a hot cha cha. And you know something? If she had started trying to make an alcoholic out of herself the day I got sober and had worked on it for 35 years and 7 months, she wouldn't have made it. She wouldn't have made it because alcohol doesn't do for her what it does for me. You know? She takes one drink and she gets drowsy. She takes two and she goes to sleep at the dinner table. Don't treat me like that. I take two and don't go to the dinner table. The hell with that. You don't build a fire just to put it out. So it's good to know this difference. It's good to know. And of course, I bought it when I've still got it. And I haven't had to take a drink. 35 years and 7 months. So, I have a great deal of fun with this. Because, you know, presently, we have a lot of experts in the field of alcoholism. Real good experts. Many of them are very good, really. Yeah. I'm thinking of one guy right now that has done a fantastic job. He's non-alcoholic. He was a captain in the United States Navy. He started dry dock number one, Terminal Island, with the help of a chap by the name of Dick Jewell, God rest his soul. Dick was a alcoholic. The captain's a non-alcoholic. And he was a retired commander of the United States Navy. And Dick and myself were pretty close to the formation of this thing. But Zuzka, God rest him, he's still alive. He's a hell of a man. Non-alcoholic. He was the head man down there. And for his effort, and many of us, that little thing, dry dock number one, turned the entire attitude of the United States military around. And they passed the rules that you couldn't even discharge a serviceman or woman for alcoholism until you'd given them a chance at rehabilitation. And it's still on the books, and they're still doing it. And this was directly due to Dr. Joe Zuzka's idea. And he, Dr. Zuzka, is a very good friend of mine. My picture is right across the desk from him. He keeps it right there. He looks at it. And we fight like cats and dogs. Because he thinks that alcohol causes alcoholism. Yeah, he does. Then I know better. Alcohol don't cause alcoholism. If drinking alcohol caused alcoholism, not drinking it caused sobriety. But it don't. It don't. Witness the fact that I was a periodic for the last 11 years I drank. Because I was not going to be beaten by that bottle. I became a periodic 11 years before I came to this program. And I was dry as them this morning between every two drunks for 11 years. And I always got drunk again. Always. So, not drinking does not cause sobriety. It causes dryness. We get dry. But it don't cause sobriety. You see, as far as I'm able to perceive, and I spent lots of time with you and me in this program, as far as I'm able to perceive, there's only one reason I'm not drunk right now. There is just one reason. There's not two. There's just one. And the reason is, I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I've got it. The thing I was looking for in the bottle. Now, what's the thing? It's the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. There's nothing in a bottle, pill, needle, pot, or acid that can do anything for me but tear me down. I've got it. There's no use to drop anything because I've got what I was looking for. The ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with myself. And when I can do that, I haven't the slightest difficulty with you. I can live with anybody. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. The thing I could not find. And I looked so, so long and so hard. You see, I was born in a family that's too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. We didn't have nothing. And having nothing, we had to get it. Half my family was Methodist Church South. The other half was Hartzell Baptist. I just left the Jesuit retreat. So, we were taught that you didn't even have to sin yourself to go to hell. You had to get saved to keep from going to hell. You know. And it was because of some thing they call the original sin. Now, that's sort of secretive, that original sin. Because they never told us what it was. And we thought they ought to tell us, you know. What the hell was it that got us in all that mess? But they wouldn't tell us, so we figured out for ourselves. We figured that it probably had something to do with Adam rearranging Eve's leaves. And I think we were closer to it than they were. But in order to keep from going to hell, you had to get saved. So when I was 13, we had a revival. And I went down to get saved. And I prayed like hell, and nothing happened. And the preacher joined me, and we both prayed like hell. And nothing happened. And every once in a while, he'd say to me, "How you doing?" I'd say, "No good." So we'd start over. And the old boy finally got tired out. And he says, "Well, when you're finally baptized, it'll happen." And when the ice went out, I went in. And he ducked me. And he brought me up. He says, "How you doing?" I said, "No good. I'm all wet." Well, he says, "When you're taken into the church, it'll happen." And I was, and it didn't. And that's when I was 13. And from 13 to 43... 30 years. I was a student of every religion and philosophy that the world knows anything about. I was trying to find out why I got gypped. And I went through the whole deal. And I got very learned in religion and philosophy. I could counsel the Pope. I know, because I counseled drunks. I'd go right into the bar, you know, and I'd sit down with him and I'd counsel him. I'd tell him how to live. And I could get by with it until I fell off the bar stool. And when I couldn't even get back on the bar stool, I lost my credibility. So I was known as a drunken deacon for about 15 years before I got here. Knew a lot intellectually, but knew nothing. And I ended up at the ripe old age of 43, a failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and drunk. Every department of life, a failure. And I came here, not even looking for God, not even thinking about God. Looking for some way that I wouldn't have to drink now so I could use the time. Rubbing out the record. Because I never in all my drinking career got to the place where I didn't love my wife and my kids. They knew I didn't. So told me time and again. And how could I tell them that it was because I loved them that I got drunk? You can't sell that bill of goods, but it's true. You see, I can look at my wife and my kids between drunks when I was as dry as I am right now. And I wanted to take in my arms and say, look, I love you. I'll never do this again. But I couldn't because I'd already done it. And I knew I was going to do it again because I didn't know how not to. You see, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And I knew I was going to get drunk again and I was going to crucify him again. And all I could do, my bed was just that far from my wife's. For all these years, it might have been in, might as well have been in Siberia. Many, many, many times. Hundreds of times. I'd lie there in my bed until I could tell by her breathing. She was asleep. And cry that pillow full of tears. Because I knew what I was doing. You see? And I didn't know what to do about it. And I knew that I wasn't going to live very long when I came to January 1946. But it was all right. I didn't care. But such time as I had, I must use rubbing out the record. And that's when I called you, found you, and came. And of course, found life. What a fortunate bunch of people we are. What a fortunate bunch of people we are. To all intents and purposes in this world's evaluations, the people right here in this room this morning don't mix. They don't mix. But you damn Mexicans. Blacks. Irishmen. You know? Bunch of tramps. We don't belong together. But we are. We are. The most beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we love each other. We love each other. And a wet drunk isn't easy to love, right? It pretty nearly takes one to love one. Don't you think so? And we do. We love each other. So, right. I knew that the gang that I was talking to were drunks because they were marked up like me. And I knew they weren't drunk because I saw their eyes. And I heard their voices. And I was comfortable there. Now, I knew I couldn't have what you had because I didn't have enough left to get it. And I wasn't going to live long enough anyway. All I wanted to know is how not to live and not to drink right now so I could use the time. And I started trying to rub out a record. But I was back there every night. Drew me like a magnet. Because it was comfortable. That was the first reason. The second reason, I didn't have any place else to go. That helps. You know. So I'm back every night, and this is my experience. After 6 months, I made my first discovery. I discovered that I hadn't had a drink or pill for 6 months. Longest time in 28 years, that I hadn't had a drink. And I hadn't had a drink or pill. for 6 months, and I was so tickled about it. I got real busy trying to give this thing to other people. And another 6 months went by, and I discovered I had a family. And they were living like kittens. Beautiful. And that was a great discovery. And another year went by, and I discovered that I was still trying to going down to the office, trying to clean up that desk down there. And business was good. Business was good. And another year went by, and I discovered my state of being was better than anything I'd ever known. It was just good to breathe in and out, you know. Terrific. And now 6 years have gone by, and I discovered I was never alone anymore. I had a God of my very own. Wherever I am, He is. And that's the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over and life begins. The God of my very own. And herefore, at that time, 49 years, I thought I'd walked alone. It's really only 43. Because the thing happened when everything burned out. When the excuses were gone and the I wants were gone. That's when it happened, but I discovered it 6 years later. Now, since that time, I'm by myself a great deal, but I'm never alone. Never been alone since. Now, here's the wonder of wonders. Before I'd ever found you guys, because I had to find out where to find you. And I knew where the office was. And my boss man had sent word to the house that if I ever step foot in the plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And the window that he had picked out for that purpose don't open. It's plate glass. And I went down there knowing that he was going to throw me through the window. But you see, he'd paid me something. He'd paid me for something the last year that I hadn't done. And I had to get even with him. And I went down there, knowing what he was going to do. And he saw my old car in the parking lot. And he knew that I was on the premises. And he knew I wasn't going to stay. So he busted in my office like a bull in a china closet. And I couldn't have defended myself with a shotgun. Because I didn't have the shakes, I had the leaps. And all I could do was sit there and look at him and say, Victor, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that I didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I have to get even with you. And the old boy stopped in his tracks. And he says, what the hell's happened to you, Charlie? I says, don't know. And I didn't. But he didn't throw me through the window. Now I sat down at the same desk that I'd hated. Doing the same job that I'd hated. For the same boss that I'd hated. And there was only one difference. This time, I wasn't trying to get anything from me. I wanted to rub out a record. 11 years later, I bought that business. Absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. When I could talk, I talked to my wife. And this is what I said to her. I says, honey, it's no longer of any importance to me whether I live under this roof. It is of absolutely no importance to me at all. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as the two of us live. But what? If I can ever add anything to your life, let me give it to you. And we closed the book. It's never been reopened. I called the boys in. And I said, boys, there's no father in the household any longer. You don't need to love me, you don't need to respect me, and you don't need to obey me. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as you live, but what? If I ever have anything, be it money, counsel, or blood, that'll add to your life, let me give it to you. And we close the book, and it's never been reopened. Not only did the business straighten out, but the family straightened out. I still got it. And we live like kittens. What am I talking about? I'm talking about a living problem and a living answer. Alcoholism is a living problem. And we have to. We have to find a living answer, lest we die. And I have come to believe that there's no such thing as a living answer that does not include a personally satisfactory, conscious partnership with the living God that made us in the entire business of living. Now, everything that I had beaten my brains out to get for 43 years and ended up without it has come into my life. And I wasn't trying to get anything. When I sold that business some dozen years ago, I was a rich man. And I didn't even know I was getting rich. Because I was just helping God's kids do things they need to have done because I wanted to. I never spent 5 seconds trying to get my wife or the kids, trying to sell them a bill of goods. Not 5 seconds. But now I can't run them off with a bucket and a broom. I'm stuck with them. And they love me and I love them. Fantastic. Trying to go someplace all my life. And I went through the gates of insanity and death. And I quit trying to go anyplace. I've been all over the world. I sat down up to retreat across the table from a guy. I said, this guy, I know you from someplace. He says, you know where? I said, no, but I know you from someplace. He said, would you believe Christ Church? You know where that is? It's the bottom of New Zealand. I met that guy at Christ Church in New Zealand a few years back. So since I quit going in place, I've been all over the world, you know. So, I do not believe what I believe today. And I'm going to close this a little bit. I don't want to. I'd rather stand here all afternoon. But you have been here a long time. And I want to see those hostesses again for a minute. So, I don't believe what I believe today. Because St. Francis told us about it. You know, he says, it's better to love than be loved. It's better to understand than to be understood. For it is in giving that we receive, in forgiving that we're forgiven, and in dying that we awaken to eternal life. Of course, I didn't like that dying, so I first said to myself, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? And so I said to me, he means surrender, dying to self or surrender. That's what he means. But I can't go out here and tell these Roman Catholics that St. Francis meant dying to self or surrender. I gotta have a little authority. So I called up Man Reason, and I got one of the Jebbies on the line. And I said, listen to what I did to St. Francis' prayer. I said, he meant in dying to self or surrender that we awaken to eternal life. You know what that mutt said to me? What the hell do you think he meant? Just like he'd known it all the time. He never even thought of it till I told him. So, I got some authority. You see, I knew that if I went out here and talked to you monkeys about changing St. Francis' prayer without a little authority, and you'd throw me out of the society. Because if you took all the Catholics and the Southerners out of our society, you could hold an international convention in a phone booth. So, I not only changed St. Francis' prayer, but I changed the Lord's prayer. Because there's a line in that that I never did like. I changed that a long time before I met you guys. Because I knew that no God could lead me into temptation. That don't fit with the word God at all in my way of thinking. So I thought that thing, lead us not into temptation, was a misquote. And I changed it. Thou leadeth us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. Now that was a long time ago. And when I got enough money to buy a New Testament, direct translation from Aramaic, which was the tongue of Jesus, I was reading it and it said, thou leadest us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thought I knew better than I knew. And I also changed my 11th step. It's too tough for me. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and power to carry it out. Too many words. So I changed it. When I wake up, and I wake up now, I don't come to. When I wake up, I say, look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the very best I can with what I got. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction, power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. And I go about my business. In total expectancy of guidance and direction. And I get it. And you might say to me, how do you know? Again, I never had a secret. This is the only easy life I've ever known. The only good life that's ever been mine. Now I'm convinced, totally convinced, that God is our Father. And we're His kids. And if one of us is kid, all of us are. If one of us is not, none of us is. And I am, so you is. So quit worrying. Quit worrying. We're God's kids. And the carpenter man said something about that. He says, who by taking thought can add one cubit to his stature? Now that means to me this. That you and I cannot change the reality of our own being. We can only change our experience in reality. For instance, sickness is very real as an experience, but it is not reality. Anger, resentment, hate, hell is very real as an experience, but it is not reality. For instance, I sit in the same chair today that I sat in for 10 years in hell. and 35 years in heaven. The same chair. Now, nothing happened to the chair. Nothing happened to the living room. Nothing happened immediately to the wife and the kids. But something happened to me. And I sit in that same chair in heaven. Now, to me, that's a sermon as long as from here to Mars and back. And it says to me, heaven was always in that chair. You were in hell. So we can not change the truth of our being. We can only change our experience in it. We can deny it. We can do anything, but we can't change the fact that we are our Father's kids. And someday, all of us have to come back home to the living God that made us. Because we're His kids. And He's always known that. You and I have to discover it for ourselves. And the finest formula on the face of the earth, so far as I'm concerned, the finest formula that was ever conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God, is our formula. Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't trade it for anything that I've ever read, heard about, dreamed about, or seen. There's nothing that I know that I think is a cut above our society. I'm never so comfortable as when I'm with you. Never so comfortable. And when I'm with you, I'm with God. It's fantastic. I love this program, and I love you. And I'm delighted that I've had this little time with you. And I am signing off now. Go with God. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.